Under President George H.W. Bush, Mr. Barr served as Deputy Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General of the Office of Legal Counsel, and the 77th Attorney General of the United States. During this first stint as Attorney General, Mr. Barr pioneered programs and strategies to reduce violent crime, to defend civil rights, to prosecute financial crime, and importantly, to coordinate counterterrorism activities for the Department of Justice, including the DOJ investigation of the Pan Am 103 bombing and Gulf War I investigations. Next, Mr. Barr spent two decades in the private sector, serving as Executive Vice President and General Counsel for both GTE and Verizon. This was followed by of counsel positions at Kirkland & Ellis. On December 7, 2018, President Trump nominated Mr. Barr to serve a second time, and he was confirmed as the 85th Attorney General of the United States. He is one of only two people in American history to serve twice as Attorney General. On October 11, 2019, Attorney General William Barr delivered his definitive speech on religious freedom and conscience rights at Notre Dame Law School, and you can watch the video online, which concluded with this exhortation. We must be vigilant to resist efforts by the forces of secularization to drive religious viewpoints from the public square and to impinge upon the free exercise of our faith. And having served 5 years in the nonprofit sector defending religious liberty and freedom, I thought that this was one of the crowning accomplishments of his second term as Attorney General. And since leaving the Department of Justice, Mr. Barr has authored a new book. It is entitled One Damn Thing After Another, which candidly reminds me of my work at the district court. And I can't wait to read it. Now, we're gonna do a fireside chat format for this event, and the moderator will be Will Levy. He is a partner and appellate specialist in Sidley Austin's Washington, D.C. office. Mr. Levy is a graduate of Stanford University and Yale Law School, and he too has served in multiple branches of government, actually all three. So he was a law clerk to Judge Anthony Sirica on the Third Circuit, and also Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito. He was chief counsel to Senator Mike Lee and staff director of the United States Senate Judiciary Committee's Subcommittee on Antitrust, Competition Policy, and Consumer Rights. And most recent and most relevant to his moderator role today, Mr. Levy served as chief of staff and senior counsel to Attorney General William P. Barr. At this point, Mr. Levy, you have the microphone.
Are these working?
Okay. Can everyone hear me? Okay. Well, first I'd like to thank the Society for having me here and greet all the members of the judiciary who are here, many of whom are friends of mine, and also some of my former colleagues from the department, including the U.S. Attorney from Dallas, Erin Neely Cox, and her husband, Trey, and also the U.S. Attorney from here in Austin, Greg Silfer, who was also on my staff as a senior counselor. I also don't want this day to pass without saying something about Ken Starr. But for this event, I would be over in Waco. I started working with Ken in 1982 when I was at the Reagan White House. I was actually there for a little over a year and a half. But it turned out to be a very pivotal time in my life, and one of the pleasures of that time was working with Ken, who, as you all know, was a superb lawyer and just a wonderful man. And we're all saddened by his passing. So I just wanted to make note of that. So with that, I guess I'll turn it over to Will.
And I will then quickly turn it right back. But let's start at the beginning, and it seems inevitable now, but looking back, what drew you to the law? How did you become a lawyer? Why did you decide to pursue a career in the law?
Well, if you've already read my book, I'm sorry to bore you with this answer, but I only went to law school because my mother nagged me and made me do it. I'd always wanted to work in the CIA. That had been my career goal. When I was a junior in this Shishi private school in New York, I told the college guidance counselor, he said, well, you know, what are you thinking of for the general direction you're going to take in life? And I said, I want to be director of the CIA. He almost fell off his chair. This was in the 60s during the Vietnam War. So that was an unusual, But anyway, then I studied Chinese at Columbia, got my master's in Chinese government and Chinese studies and Chinese language, and went and worked for the CIA. But as I was going down there, my mother insisted that, as a child of the Depression, she insisted that I have a profession. So she said, go to law school. So I went at night to GW while I worked at the CIA. And I used to say that I learned about rights at night and I violated them during the day. But that's really why I went to law school. But I actually did very well. And I was a night law student and had never been in a law firm or anything. And then when Bush left the CIA, my big break professionally was getting to work with H.W. Bush when he was the director of CIA. So it's strange how these things happen. And one of the lessons for young lawyers is have a plan, pursue the plan, have some purpose, but don't be afraid to abandon it and take opportunities and push on doors that open up. So when Carter came into office, I decided to leave, and someone said, you know, you're top in your class, you should apply for a clerkship. I didn't know anything about clerkship, so I applied for a clerkship and I got it. And that sort of set me off on a legal career. But I was certainly, you know, at night law school, I'd never been in a law school, I just want to tell it. So I went for my first interviews during my clerkship. And the first firm I went to was this boutique, very fancy boutique litigation firm in Washington. And I'm sitting there being interviewed, and I didn't realize that basically you're supposed to express awe and admiration for the partner who's telling you all about their legal work. So this guy was telling me about all his cases in the Supreme Court, and I sat there, and he said, do you have any questions? And my daughter was scheduled to have open heart surgery, and I said, yes, what kind of medical coverage do you have? The look on his face was priceless. It was like, I can't believe this base character asking about such things like that. It's the only firm I didn't get an offer from. But anyway, go ahead.
So by the time President Trump offered you the AG position, you'd already had a most distinguished career in the law, including you had actually been the Attorney General before. So if it's just one damn thing after another, why do it again?
Well, it was a lot of fun doing it under Bush. We had our one damn things after another, but we also were able to accomplish a lot, and I felt there was a lot of unfinished business at the department. So it's not all a bad memory, but I had no desire to go back into government, and I never thought I would go back into government. I was 69, I was of counsel at Kirkland. I had some really nice clients that I was helping out. I was on some big public company boards. It was really an ideal situation. I had my grandchildren arriving, and I was enjoying smelling the flowers. And I couldn't have written a better script for myself at that juncture of life. But I saw what was taking shape. I felt that it was critical that the Trump administration succeed. I had supported him once he got the nomination. I was never a never Trumper because I felt our country was going to be pushed over a cliff if we had another 4 years of progressive democratic rule. But I saw this Russiagate nonsense. I was very suspicious of it from the very beginning, and I felt it was being used to oust him from office. Or I was at least concerned about that. I also felt that the Department of Justice and the FBI, two institutions that I really care deeply about, because they were drawn into the political fray, they were being used as weapons against Trump administration. I felt they were getting battered from all sides. And I thought it was important that the president get someone in there who could stabilize the situation. And I kept on proposing other people. I was asked, you know, to suggest some people, and I'd throw out names, and none of them were getting any traction, and they kept on coming back saying, well, you know, the president would like to talk to you. I didn't want to talk to him unless I knew I would accept it. It would have been a waste of his time. So I talked to my wife, and she, who had been opposed to it, and said, you're never going to change this guy. You're just, you know, nothing you do is really going to ultimately stick with him. She was, she's a very wise woman, but I didn't do it for that reason. I did it, so all my business friends in New York, many of whom had worked with him, some had been in his company, told me, do not go near this guy, you know? And so I was under no illusions about the difficulty of working with him, and also, you know, I didn't care if I ended up as his best buddy. I was going in to run the Department of Justice. And I just decided all the reasons for me not doing it had to do with my personal comfort and financial situation and lifestyle versus I felt the country's at a critical juncture and I thought I could help. So at the end of the day, I agreed to talk to him. And that's why I went in.
So going back again, when George H.W. Bush offered you the attorney generalship, he said to you, the best politics at DOJ is no politics at DOJ. Can you reflect on that a little bit?
Yeah, I was, so I had been the head of OLC, which was the most fun job I've ever had in government. And I only had that for a year before I became acting deputy and then deputy attorney general. Because Don Ayer, who had been the deputy appointed by under Thornburg, blew himself up after 6 months. He just got into a big, he and Thornburg couldn't get along, so Thornburg fired him. And I moved up to deputy. And then Thornburg was gonna run for Senate in Pennsylvania. So there was a period of time where I was acting attorney general. And that's when Clarence Thomas was going through confirmation. And the idea was after he's through, the president was gonna make a final decision. I didn't really think I was a candidate because names were popping up like Ashcroft at that time, Duke Bajan, the governor of California. And I wasn't a political figure. And I figured, you know, it's an election year. I don't bring anything to the, you know, to the administration politically. But he did go with me and I was told to go in and talk to him in the Oval Office. And I said, you know, Mr. President, I don't really bring you anything here, but I'm honored that you. And he said, I don't bring you anything politically. He said, the best politics at justice is no politics, which I thought was a pretty good aphorism, just to spat off the top of his head. But he said, you know, you've been running it with a sure hand, very professionally, and that's what I want you to do. And he was a joy to work with. He's a real gentleman. He was not a pushover. I mean, he had very clear views, and he could be, you know, show us a spine of steel. He didn't interfere at all in what I was doing, and gave me backing on all the law enforcement stuff I could ask for. So that was a great experience. And I think he's right. I think the best politics at the Department of Justice is no politics. Just, you know, try to run the place as professionally as you can. And part of that in this day and age means having, you know, being willing to stop in, you know, political hanky-panky that's going on, even though you know the media is gonna be all over you on it and really go after you. I mean, that's one of the reasons I actually came to the conclusion, maybe I should talk to Trump, because we live in an era of personal destruction. And I felt sorry for the 40 and 50 year old political appointees because they were presented some hot potatoes, and if they made a principled decision, the media would just go after them. And that could be difficult for them professionally going forward. My attitude was, you know, I don't really need a job after this. I'm not looking for a job after this. I don't really care. And so I felt I could afford to really be independent and make the decisions I thought were right, including when I saw stuff going on like, the Mueller debacle, but also the Stone sentencing controversy, where the line prosecutors who had worked for Mueller, and one of them had worked in the Obama White House, you know, came in and wanted to propose three times the normal sentence that would have been given for the particular obstruction offense. I knew I was going to get roasted in the press, but I overruled them. That's what it takes nowadays, I think, to hold those offices, given the conduct, the hyper-partisan conduct of the media.
Yeah. So on August 8th, the FBI conducted a search of the former president's home club at Mar-a-Lago. How should we be thinking about the search and the president's apparent conduct?
Well, when it first happened, I, called around and suggested to some of my Republican friends, you may not want to go out on a limb on this one. because knowing Trump, I knew there was probably a problem there. And I had actually caught wind of the fact that back in January of 2022, people were very upset at his behavior about the handling of documents, not people in the administration, people in his own circle. So I said, look, the best thing tack to take is, this is pretty extreme act, this is very serious, it's troubling, you better have a good reason for it. We're all ears, at some point we want to be persuaded that this was appropriate. But not to go further than that. Needless to say, so my read of the whole situation basically is it was genuinely being driven over concern about sensitive documents that he had retained. It wasn't going after any treasure trove of documents there in Russiagate or anything like that. And I think the department and the FBI, I think, have actually acted, with some restraint. They didn't make this thing public. They were trying to get the documents by jawboning, and he was jerking them around. And, people say, well, why would he want to keep the document? Because he's Donald J. Trump. And, it's like a dog with a bone. He wanted the documents because the government wanted the documents. And that was not in keeping with his image of himself as the rightful president. So he started playing games. And he wasn't following the advice of his lawyers. And he took it too far. And I feel that, and I think McCarthy's article today in the National Review is bang on. I said the same thing on TV. The government probably has enough right now just to indict him. This was me, I would be indicted, and I wouldn't expect anything different. Whether they will exercise their discretion in this to go after the former president, I think depends on the sensitivity of the information how bad the evidence is of obstruction and deceit directly involving the president. And if they have strong evidence in both those areas, I think there's a good chance he'd be indicted. But like McCarthy, it's not necessarily in the Democratic administration's interest to indict him. So I'm not sure how that's going to come out. But if I were representing the president right now, I'd say, look, you have to understand, if you're not indicted, it's because of their discretion, not because you have a defense. And act accordingly, because the more you're in their face with stuff about the FBI planting this and that you mentally declassified all this stuff and so forth, if I were the attorney general, if anything, that would tempt me to pull the trigger on you. So I'm not sure it's a good posture for him.
Okay, well, maybe we'll return to that in the audience Q&A. During both of your tenures as attorney general, violent crime was a serious issue. What is the role of the attorney general vis-a-vis the police and crime and criticism of the police?
Police, crime, and criticism of the police. In 1991-92, crime peaked in the United States. It had gone up for five decades from 1960 to 1990, it had quintupled. biggest climb ever in our history. And up till that time, the federal government had pretty narrow activities fighting violent crime. You know, it was mostly, you know, large drug organizations, bank robberies, things like that. And I was deputy and persuaded Thornburg that we had to do something. Crime was becoming a huge issue. I mean, it's much worse than, you know, probably twice as worse, maybe not twice, but pretty close to that, as bad as it is today. And so we had, our strategy was joint task forces, work with the states, use our mandatory minimums on guns and drugs to incapacitate the worst actors, have the states turn them over to us, the task forces, we channel them to the federal government, and put those people in prison for a long time. Increase number of prisoners. While crime was quintupling, the prison population had dropped, had continuously dropped for all that period of time. So our idea was incapacitation. Take the repeat violent offenders, the chronic violent offenders, put them away for a significant period of time. Generally, recidivism only drops after about 40 years old. And so if you take a guy who's in their 20s and they're a repeat violent offender and they go away for 20 years, chances are they're not going to commit crimes when they get out, or as many crimes, chances are. But anyway, that was the theory. So prison population doubled over the next 22 years. Crime was cut in half over 22 consecutive years, constant drop. Until Obama in 2014 started the revolving door again and started the war on cops, going after cops. Crime then went up until Trump came in, then it started going down again. In 2020, the year of COVID, we just couldn't keep the cap on it. The year we had started with more joint task forces, trying to flood certain cities with federal agents to essentially do the same tactics we had before, and we were making a difference, but you know, grand juries were shut down, it was very hard, and then when COVID really took hold, it just, crime exploded all over the country, and it's still going up, it's still out of control. And in my view, this is not going to stop on its own, it's not going to burn itself out, it'll just keep on getting worse and worse. And until there are prosecutors in state, and state officials who reform their systems and start working in tandem with the federal government and have an administration that really has a theory about what to do about violent crime. I just want to say that throughout this entire period, you always had these chirping voices in the back, you know, we should address the root causes, sort of like Vice President Harris's approach to the border, root causes, which means let's not do anything, okay? And I don't know what the root causes of crime are. I think it has to do with the absence of fathers more than anything else. That's the strongest correlation. It's not poverty. But I'm perfectly willing to let people attack root causes if they can figure out how to do it. And of course, we've been doing it since the Great Society without success. All I know is that blood is flowing today, and we're not waiting for root causes solution in 20 years. And number two, any of your solutions are going to be strangled in the crib unless we can get control of the streets. So, you know, you can set up a school, but if the school is run by gangs, you know, it's not going to help people get out of poverty or anything else. So, and you know, our job at the Department of Justice and law enforcement is to deal with the bloodletting. You be my guest, you go in, but it's not an alternative. Dealing with root crimes is not an alternative to law enforcement. So that in a nutshell is my view on violent crime. And you know, we tried to turn the thing around, overwhelmed, didn't get much support from Congress in terms of more money and you know, so it was very hard to do in the last year.
You brought back the federal use of capital punishment after almost two decades without a single execution. What was that effort like?
I felt a sense of satisfaction because, not in a ghoulish way, but because the whole point of the Department of, I mean, one of the responsibilities of the Attorney General is to carry out the sentence of the court. And, you know, for years, all administrations, Republican and Democrat, have been seeking the death penalty, have argued for the death penalty in cases, have gotten it, have litigated for 20 years to sustain it and throughout courts, but Clinton and Obama didn't carry out the death penalty. These people were just stacking up in on death row. And yet they continued to seek the death penalty. And my view was, look, if a court and a jury, you know, if a jury and a court end up imposing 15 years on someone, the Attorney General doesn't come in and say, this shocks my conscience. I think that's too severe. I don't morally agree with this sentence in this case, so I'm going to let him out now. I'm not going to carry out the sentence. And to me, it's the same with the death penalty. Once the jury decides on the death penalty and it's upheld through 20 years of litigation, the Attorney General is duty bound to carry out the sentence. The only reason it was stopped, and I get this question all the time, is, you know, you and articles still say that I went on a death spree, you know, during an election year, that I just sort of started the death penalty. No, the death penalty was stopped by Holder, and he didn't stop it on moral grounds. He stopped it because we didn't have the chemicals to carry it out that had been approved and litigated as constitutionally appropriate. And so he tasked the Bureau of Prisons to go out and come up with a protocol for imposing the death penalty. And when I came into office, the protocol had been decided and was sitting on my desk. So the protocol was unquestionably constitutional. And the reason for the moratorium had gone away. And apparently, unlike Merrick Garland, I thought it's my duty to carry out the death penalty. So we started scheduling them. Now, I better not tell that story. We had 64 people on death row, and I told the Bureau of Prisons, get these things scheduled. And I meant the 13, you know, there were about 13 that had exhausted all their appeals and had killed vulnerable victims like children and so forth. And I came back and they had scheduled 64 in 6 months. I said, no. but anyway, so we carried them out. Now, as I say in my book, I personally agree with the death penalty, and I make the argument for the death penalty in my book. Whether I agreed with it or not, if I felt I couldn't carry out the death penalty, then I shouldn't be Attorney General. That's part of the duty of the job. So that, and I have to say that a lot of people at the department did a great job litigating that. And, you know, the death penalty has been thwarted by gamesmanship in the court system for too long and by judges, willful district court judges, who do everything they can to stop the imposition of the penalty. And the Supreme Court wasn't going to take that stuff. And they, you know, we were able to push them all through essentially on schedule. So.
As the 2020 election approached, you spoke with Trump and you offered him some advice. What did you say to him, and did he take the advice?
So in April of 2020, around the spring of 2020, in April I went in to talk to him. Everybody around him, the staff, or at least everyone who I was aware of having a view, felt he was headed for defeat in the election. One group went in, some individuals who had been successful lawyers who had involved themselves in campaigns in the past, and their advice to him was, you need to get a big national law firm, the way you did in 2016 with Jones Day, and you need to get it orchestrating all the litigation around the country, especially in Georgia and Pennsylvania, and because these rules are being, they're using COVID to change all these rules, and you need to be very aggressive in this stuff. Now, you're going to have to put $20 to $30 million in escrow, because no law firm is going to do this work because you don't pay your lawyers unless you put the money in escrow. He just ignored it. He just ignored that advice. And he never put together the kind of legal effort that was necessary. And the other advice which I gave them, and then, you know, others like Jared and I think Pompeo and many others. But I was the first, it was sort of orchestrated, it was sort of like an intervention, and I was the first to go in. And I told him, look, I think you're gonna lose. I said, what he usually does is when he looks at you and he knows you're gonna tell him something he doesn't wanna hear, he usually filibusters, so you can never say anything. I said, you can't filibuster, you have to listen to what I say. He said, okay. I said, I think you're gonna lose the election. And you're gonna lose the election because there's this group of Republican and independent voters who generally lean Republican who think you're an asshole. And they're not gonna vote for you unless you start tuning, you know, dialing this back a little bit. It doesn't have to be a big adjustment, but you have to stop being so truculent and obnoxious and punching down and getting into fights with every grade B actor who criticizes you. And he said, well, you know, my base, they love me as a fighter. My base wants my base. And I said, number one, your base is with you and will come out for you. That's not what's really up for grabs in this election. And number two, I said, you know, I don't mean to be impertinent, but, you know, in traveling around the country, which I had done more than any cabinet sector, and I go into police precincts and sports bars and other places like that. I have never been approached by anyone in your base who hasn't said exactly the same thing, and this is true. They always say, we love the president, we love you, oh, thank you for all you're doing, blah, blah. Would you just tell the president to dial it back just a little bit? Stop tweeting, stop being, and that's true. And his base had that feeling. So he didn't listen to this advice. A lot was riding on his victory, and people kept on telling him, you know, Western civilization is on your shoulders, basically. You gotta sober up and, you know, run a strong campaign. And he didn't. The campaign was a lousy campaign. He ran out of money, for Christ's sake. He had over $1.5 billion, and he ran out of money in the fall. So it was a lackluster effort, and then I think, you know, the first debate was in and of itself a catastrophe, in and of itself that lost the election. And then canceling the second debate, by the time he had the next debate, 65% of the country had already voted. So it was a pretty poor performance, I think, in the election. And it wasn't, and as we'll get into if you want to, you know, it wasn't stolen. He ran behind the Republican Party, so it wasn't a good effort.
What is your assessment of that election? Are there problems we should address?
Well, you know, my feeling is, and I said all along, and you know, the liberal media was apoplectic because I kept on talking about the need to make sure the vote, you know, had integrity, and I spoke out against universal mail-in ballots and other things. I spoke out against harvesting. But there are two different questions. One question is, do people have confidence in the election results? And my view is, if they see the protections being diluted, the anti-fraud protections being diluted, they're not gonna have confidence in the outcome, whether or not there was actually voter fraud. And then the next question is, what can you show sufficient voter fraud to upset the election results? People mesh together, I think, three different things. One is the rule changes, the changing of the playing field during the year, taking advantage of COVID, which sort of skewed the playing field, but in and of themselves were not illegal. Those were the rules of the game. And to the extent there's an argument they were illegal because they weren't adopted by the state legislature, you gotta litigate that before the election, and have that resolved before the election. Because once the election is held, you gotta win within the game, the rules that are in place at the time. Furthermore, that litigation, the Department of Justice doesn't come in and litigate that. The campaigns and the candidate and so forth do. The second thing people got confused about is things like violations of rules that were meant to protect against fraud, such as anti-harvesting rules, or, you know, observe, both parties have to have observers in the room, that kind of thing. When those are violated, that's not proof of fraud. That's an opportunity for fraud, but not proof of fraud. and you still have to go in, and this is still a matter for state enforcement, not federal, you still have to go in and show that, that there was some hanky-panky during that period. It's not enough just to say, well, you know, the observers weren't there for 15 minutes. What's the remedy? Throwing out all the votes from that precinct? Throwing out the votes that were cast during that period? And so that's the second set of issues. And the third one is the one the president seized on election night, which is fraud, which is people who are not entitled to vote or dead people vote, and people who should vote, their votes are excluded. Or can vote, their votes are excluded somehow or manipulated. And I still feel there was no evidence of significant fraud in that election that has been brought forward. And I don't think there was fraud that would upset the result. Fraud is something that the Justice Department has jurisdiction over. Now, I mean, I will say that I caught a lot of grief because the deep state in the department, so to speak, had come up with this rule. Their application of the non-interference rule was that, that is non-interference in elections, is that no allegation of fraud should be investigated until the election is actually certified and completely done, which to me is counterintuitive. And I changed that, and I said, no, it has to be case by case. And, you know, it depends on the magnitude and its ability to affect the election, and also whether there's time before the election to fix the problem. And some allegations came forward that we had time to fix before the election. But I caught endless grief for that. But that did enable us to look at major allegations of fraud after Election Day, and the stuff that was being spouted by the president and by Giuliani and his ace legal team were just not complete and utter nonsense. They were nonsense. And just to give you, I mean, on January 13th of this year, when he was confronted on National Public Radio and said, what is your best example of election fraud? Now, you would have thought after all this time he would have had, you know, thought maybe his best punch, right? He said, more people voted in Philadelphia than there are voters. Well, that's completely wrong. The turnout in Philadelphia was, you know, in the 70% range, somewhere in there. It was basically consistent with the rest of the state. And he actually ran stronger in Philadelphia than he did in 2016. So anyway, that's my take. And when you go and you look, what gives me some comfort on this is when you go and look at the voting patterns, he ran stronger in the rural areas than he did before. He ran a little bit stronger in some of the major cities, but he fell behind. He ran weaker in the suburbs. Even the suburbs that he won and the exurbs that he won, his margin was not as strong as it was in 2016. He lost ground in the suburbs, as everyone told him he would. And in the battleground states of Arizona, Wisconsin, and in Pennsylvania, he ran behind the Republican ticket. He was the weak link on the Republican ticket. Well, guess what? You're not going to win a close election if you're running weaker than the down ballot Republican candidates. And I like to contrast that with Ronald Reagan, because you see Trump, people think that Trump is the second coming of Reagan and this got stolen from him. When Ronald Reagan was up for re-election in Pennsylvania, he not only won all the Republican vote, he won 470,000 Democratic votes. Almost 500,000 Democrats voted for him. That was more than enough to give him a huge margin in Pennsylvania. That's the difference. That is a landslide.
You gave a speech at Notre Dame in 2019 in which you said, among other things, that religion is what protects us from the dangers of freedom. Can you elaborate a little on that?
Well, it's just the basic idea that, yes, the Constitution is neutral in the sense of religion and that no one is required to exercise a religion or believe in a particular creed. You're free not to, and you are free to exercise one. But in a sense, not in a sense, in reality, I think the framers believed that the religion was the precondition of our constitutional system. And it basically goes back to the whole idea of separation of church and state, which how that has been bastardized is really amazing because, you know, before Christianity, the state held all the cards, and they were the moral tutor, and they had both, you know, both sacred and secular power. But the whole idea of separation of church and state comes from Christianity, render unto Caesar and render unto God. It's a Christian notion which was meant to carve out from the plenary authority of the state a private and religious zone of conscience and family life and beliefs and so forth. And the teacher after that was no longer the state. It wasn't Sparta taking your kid at 7 years old and putting it in a state dormitory, learning a state curriculum. After Christianity, the teacher was the church, even at the time of the founding. And so their view was, and what that did, what that fateful separation of church and state did, is it basically put the primary social control mechanism inside people, their moral conscience and their virtue, which was the business of the church. And the framers felt that that enabled limited government. Because our people are virtuous and religious people and can control themselves and govern themselves in that sense, without the coercive power of the state, we can afford to have limited government. And that was the whole deal. And that's why religion is essential to continuing with limited government. Where what we see nowadays is, as it fails, as people lose self-control, people reach in to use coercive state power to fill that void.
Do you think progressivism is antithetical to liberal democracy? Is this a new phenomenon that we're seeing?
Yeah, so as I explained in my book, I actually think we've sort of crossed a boundary in the last few decades, because I think our model of Republican government and, you know, democracy and so forth was sort of the liberal democratic, a unitary spectrum, so to speak, from right to left, where we all sort of agreed to certain premises of the system. And, you know, the whole idea was to try to get as much of that spectrum as you could and get your programs through. And sometimes you'd have to compromise and so forth. But we all agreed on the fundamental system. I believe that what progressive is a sort of a cutesy name for a movement that is outside of that system and that has moved over into more of a revolutionary posture, which is, you know, the same as all revolutions, right and left, which is that basically it is materialist and secular. It, as William F. Buckley used to say, it is the immanentizing the eschaton, that is, taking the final things that the Christian worldview, Judeo-Christian worldview, said were transcendent and say, no, life is just here and now, and it's all about creating an perfect equitable society here on earth, and there's historical processes in place that you have to that the vanguard can figure out and you have to cooperate with, and that's how the human race will reach salvation. So salvation becomes a temporal process supervised by the revolutionaries. And that's essentially the mentality that is increasingly seeping into the Western mind, and including among a lot of young people today. And what that says is it's all about tearing what inhibits achieving salvation for human, this earthly salvation, are, you know, people like the Federalist Society, Neanderthals, who are not just wrong, but they're evil. They're evil because they're standing in the way of salvation. And that's part of what's engendered the bitterness, but it means that anything goes, because our end is so noble that you know, we're just going to jump to what we know to be the historically right outcome, and we'll just tread over anybody. So that's the attitude of the progressives, and I think they are opposed to and trying to tear down the liberal democratic institutions and systems. So I think it's a completely different situation than we faced in the past. Yeah, and that, by the way, that's what's corrupting all our institutions. You know, people say, what are we going to do about the FBI? Well, I wish the FBI was the extent of the problem, and frankly, the problems in the FBI are a hell of a lot better than they are in many other places. Not just in government, where every agency faces this, but let's look outside the government. You know, the media, science, medicine, even the American judiciary, there are some willful people who think that the ends justify the means. What is the corruption of these institutions? So institutions are processes and a set of values that we think over time will produce a certain outcome. So the justice system, we have certain processes and values, and we hope and try to achieve justice. First Amendment is a process. Through, you know, the dialectic of competing views, we hope to arrive at truth. We don't start out saying, well, that's true and that's not true. You can speak and you can't speak. We determine truth by going through the process, and we have loyalty to those values. Let the person speak. Justice system, due process, the media. Objective truth, try to get to objective reality and truth through a certain discipline of journalism. But when people come in and they say the end, they want the outcome. They say the end we want, perfect equity, justifies our means, and therefore here I am sitting in the middle of this institution, and if I don't think it's going to kick out the result that I think is on the right side of history, then I can go and act against the values of the institution because I'm justified, because I'm going to bring about, you know, political change or whatever outcome I want. This is the obverse of cops who get frustrated with the criminal justice system and go out and start shooting criminals instead of putting them through the system. And this is the obverse of that. So I think that's essentially the dynamic behind all our institutions being corrupted. Okay.
General, thank you for speaking with us, and thank you for your service.
Thank you.